This is Forces Radio.
On the first day of 1944, RAF Bomber Command sent 421 aircraft to attack Berlin. General Dwight D. Eisenhower has just been given 6 months to organize a top secret mission that would be known as D-Day. And in Algiers, North Africa, three members of the British Armed Forces found a captured German transmitter and wrote the first lines of an epic broadcasting story.
This is the British Forces Experimental Station, Algiers.
For nearly 75 years, men and women working for a small organisation have spent more time than possibly any other group of people living and working in far-flung communities, in the middle of wars, and at the centre of major historical events. Their journey started as 1943 closed, and the tide was turning for the Allies.
Up until 1943, it had been a bit of a disaster. There'd been Dunkirk, of course, and the Blitz, the attack against Malta, which went on for 2 years. And in 1943, in fact, the coincidence was that we got into Africa. By getting into Africa, we brought the Germans into Africa, which we wanted to do, because the war there was winnable. It was possible to show people victory was possible. And if you can get victory in Africa, what can you do? You can go across the Mediterranean and go into Italy and start the big push to end the war. So the important thing was to have the technology. We got the technology to go and report what was happening as much as we could.
You can't do what we do, working with the forces and not care. I don't see how you'd be able to do that, certainly without the audience knowing. I just didn't feel that I could go on being a forces broadcaster without having gone and done an ops tour.
I think we serve them with not a sense of reverence, but with a sense of respect, because they are doing a job that I don't think I would want to do.
They bring everybody together as a community. They're always referring to groups of people that are doing perhaps charity events or Bloggs' birthday, and sometimes people's parents would come on the radio and send messages to people, and it just gave everybody a really warm feeling and that made everybody feel a part of one force.
It's as simple, I think, as just being able to blend in. You're not immediately a civilian in a military environment. You know the language, you know the humour, you know the day-to-day business, and it's second nature, so you don't stick out. And I think the worst thing you can do is draw attention to yourself and stick out, because the military is a very, very close-knit community. And if you're an oddball, not only are they going to notice, they're going to rip you.
They're doing a job I wouldn't want to do in some really bizarre places, and they're doing it to an extraordinary level of competence and compassion.
It felt very much that it was our radio station. It was very much part of who we were, our landscape, you know, for families who are based in Germany, but also the links. And I became aware of the links as I was listening to it before I deployed late in 2008 for the first time.
Every day is different, but every day has its own challenges and its own joys, because you're part of a huge and a large and a well-loved community.
The key thing about BFBS was providing a link with home. What's going on in the UK? What are people listening to? Who won the football? What's in the news? What are the papers saying?
If BFBS were a regiment, it would have regimental citations and battle honours.
It glues military communities together.
I'm Mike Howarth. I've been a Forces broadcaster for 16 years. BFBS, a radio station that was set up to talk directly to the British Armed Forces in 1944, has been doing its job for 75 years. Through World War, peacetime, conflict, peacekeeping missions, turmoil, and world-changing events, it's carried on serving a unique group of people. People whose job it is to serve their country without question. This is the story of a radio station that's been at the heart of the Forces community since 1944. This is BFBS 75, and how one radio station became a witness on history.
Starting life as the British Forces Experimental Service, using borrowed equipment, a tiny but crucial radio station set itself a goal: to talk to an audience who desperately needed a very British voice to connect it with the world. BFBS started with one voice, Major Philip Slessor, who'd been a BBC announcer and went on to become an actor.
He was the very first Forces broadcaster. He founded a group of people without whom this extraordinary project would have no voice.
This is the British Forces Experimental Station, Algiers.
Forces broadcasters are a rare breed. They're not in the Forces, but they have to understand their audience, speak their language, and understand their lives.
Servicemen and their families are a fairly astute and perceptive bunch of people. I think what makes a good soldier is knowing a fake when you see one. So you've got to be real. You can't fake empathy.
It's not a playground. It's not messing about. We're not playing DJs.
For many, one of the most outstanding examples of a Forces broadcaster is the man who once served in the RAF, then committed himself to BFBS, right up until the end of his life. Glenn Mansell.
Glenn Mansell and I became the firmest of friends, and he is one of the most consummately brilliant people I've ever had the pleasure and honour of knowing. Wind-ups aside, once you get Glenn, you've got him for life. But we really miss him.
The effect was a renewed respect for our audience. You know, I mean, we all think we can be a bit gung-ho. We all think we can deal with things in a very easy way. But it's not until you've actually experienced it yourself and then you understand that quite a significant amount of our audience have been in that situation, you start thinking about the effects that that has on families back home as well.
In 2012, Glenn Mansell lost his battle with cancer. But right up until the end, he was a fierce advocate of what BFBS does. He believed in it, and that passion for serving his audience meant that, like so many others and the audience he served, he would never question being sent to often dangerous places. In 1991, Iraqi forces invaded and occupied Kuwait. British forces rapidly joined an international coalition whose aim was to liberate Kuwait. Where there are British forces, there's a BFBS station. So Glenn packed his bag and set off to help build one.
When I arrived, it didn't seem like a war. It seemed like another BFBS station. The equipment was familiar. The only difference was it was slightly open and all the broadcasting boards had been thrown out of the window. Gulf War One, I always think about the fact that I went there a brave man and came home a wise man. And I don't think it would be the sort of thing I would have ever volunteered to do again. There were very little plans of how to get to the scene of operations in Saudi Arabia. And in fact, when I called up my masters at BFBS and said, how do you want me to get there? The answer was, work it out yourself, write it down, so when the next guy comes along, he can read your notes and do exactly the same thing. So I went across the road and found a nice soldier and said, can I have a bit of NBC training? Which they did. They put us into uniform for Gulf War One as well, and gave us our equivalent military rank slides as well, which were only to be used if we ever ended up in a situation where we were engaged by the enemy. Well, there were no rules. At that point, we were part of the army.
Former Forces broadcaster Charlie Lowndes.
It was a very interesting challenge because the war started in 1990 and built up very slowly. There was an air war that went on for many months. We were bombing them. There was a long build-up to the land war, which happened, if I remember rightly, at the end of February, beginning of March 1991. It seemed likely that we would have British forces in Kuwait for a while. Out there in the desert, engineers just got on with it and built something using a 20-foot shipping container that they acquired for cash on the docks. Got hold of one of these containers, got a drill and an angle grinder and started making holes in it to get cables in and out. The land war started and finished within, if I remember rightly, 6 days. We then said to the headquarters, can we go now? And they said, well, yes, all right. I drove into Kuwait, found the forward headquarters. 2 days later, the transmitter arrived, and that night it was on air.
My first weekend, the sirens went off, and we were able to listen to three different sets of sirens. We listened to the British ones, the American ones, and the Saudi Arabian sirens as well, so we always knew if something was going on, and then we'd be alerted as to what was actually happening over the tannoy system. Sirens went off, and there was no tannoy message, which obviously led to some sort of confusion because nobody knew exactly what was happening. And so I wandered outside to have a look, and there above me was a Scud missile. By that time, quite unstable, making its descent down towards the ground. It actually missed the ground and landed in the sea, but at that point, it managed, its exhaust fumes managed to trigger all the alarms, all the nerve agent alarms went off. And so we were immediately went into that condition where we had to put everything on, respirators had to go on. Contemplating the wisdom of sending myself down to Gulf War One and thinking, you know what, it might not have been my best call.
Travel 200 miles west and slightly north from Kuwait, and you'll find yourself at a small island in the Mediterranean. To its north is Italy, south is Libya. Malta stands out in the history of forces broadcasting in many ways. It was the first place any kind of specialist forces targeted radio had ever been heard. The year was 1932. Its champion was the Queen's late cousin, the then Fleet Wireless Officer for the Mediterranean Fleet, Lord Louis Mountbatten.
I've been personally interested in the idea of broadcasting to the forces for a long time. This dates back, in fact, to 1932, when I was the Fleet Wireless Officer of the Mediterranean Fleet. One day, the Commander-in-Chief told me to arrange for the fleet in Malta to receive what was to be the first broadcast of a reigning monarch, the Christmas message of King George V.
In 1941, as the Second World War raged towards its third year, Malta became an island under siege. Here's historian, military analyst, author, and the presenter of BFBS SITREP, Christopher Lee.
There were two sieges. One was in 1556. Then we had the air power attacks on Malta directed from Italy by German forces. Somehow the Maltese held out. And at one point, the Blitz attacks on Malta were more dangerous and more powerful than the ones on London. And at the end of it, Malta was awarded the George Cross because of the way that it held out. But the importance was the British were there, but they weren't to stay. This was part of the decolonization of all the lands that the British had taken as their own. Because Mintoff, when he was the leader of Malta, talking now about the 79-80s, wanted us out.
Former forces broadcaster Charlie Lowndes.
The summer of 1978, there was a little bit of a political spat back in London where the then Prime Minister, Mr. Mintoff's daughter, was involved in a demonstration about Irish Republican internment in the House of Commons. So she and her friend went and threw bags of horse manure at the honourable members. These days there's a glass screen to stop you doing that sort of thing. There was naturally a fuss. She was arrested. It got reported. Now, our news was delivered to us by the BBC, and we had no editorial control over it. Mr. Mintoff found this all very offensive. He said that we had broken our license terms and should close down immediately. So we did. I remember the day this happened and thinking, gosh, can they do that? Yes, I suppose they can. It's not our country anymore. And indeed, that was part of the background to being in Malta. The local Maltese government had decided the time had come for NATO to depart. The naval base, which had been British for a long, long time, would close, the RAF base would close, and British services in general would leave. So I knew before I even arrived that the station would close down. The day it happened, I remember the Royal Marines turning up. One moment there were Marines in the back of a Land Rover, the next moment there weren't. If you looked closely amongst the colonnades and pretty stone pillars, you could see a glint of a green beret here, a gun muzzle pointing out there. They were extremely professional and they knew exactly how to secure a building.
During the war, Malta was under siege. Conditions for the residents and the forces were desperate, to say the least. But in more recent conflicts, modern technology has allowed for a much better standard of living for those who serve on operations. From 2003, British troops based in Afghanistan as part of Operation Herrick were part of an ongoing effort to stabilise the region and support the building of a peaceful democratic state. For 11 years, thousands of troops had to live and work in the middle of nowhere. This called for a town to be built in the desert. The latest BFBS radio station would be built in Camp Bastion.
I didn't expect it to be quite as big as it is, and I didn't expect there to be the variety and diversity of professions out here, as well as just people with guns running around. It's been a massive eye-opener the whole week.
BBC Radio 1's Greg James during his week-long stay in Camp Bastion in 2012. Op Herrick was one of those times when BFBS had an unusually high profile. Its role serving the forces suddenly seemed even more vital. But, like the servicemen and women who served there, the BFBS team also faced some tough challenges. Station engineer Paul Wright was amongst the first of the broadcasting team to arrive at Bastion.
Camp Bastion is in the middle of a desert, really. And the military had chosen the location for security because it's almost completely flat for miles around, so nobody can really approach the base without being seen. And there's a good water supply here. And everything has to be brought in. Everything that's consumed or used has to be brought here from outside. There are no shops, there are no local towns, and if there were, you couldn't visit them because they're too dangerous. You can't just pop down to B&Q and buy some screws, and you can't phone a plumber because there aren't any. Well, there are some, but they're all busy building the things that the military need to operate. We've had transmitters out here broadcasting the radio service since 2002 when it all kicked off. Our engineers have been out here making these things work when there was nothing. Our guys have been living in military transit tents for years at a time, not their own room with a bed and a television as things are now, an internet and a phone. They'd come out here on tour with their kit with them and they wouldn't know where they were going to live. They had no vehicles to drive around with and they had a lot of heavy kit to carry. And they had it very, very austere. And I think things have changed since our broadcasting colleagues came out here and they've really improved.
I think the best way to start off the show today is with a tweet from a girl called Emma. Emma Louise 13. And Emma, thank you for your tweet. She's just said, "Can't wait to listen to your show, Greg, live from Afghanistan today. I'll feel a little bit closer to my brother as I know he'll be listening. Hashtag my hero." But we are surrounded by heroes and it's been amazing the last few days just to meet a lot of people. We've met so many inspirational people who are just very proud to do what they do.
There are a lot of people serving over Christmas and they might want to be at home with their friends and families. But even if they've nothing to do with the military and they couldn't give a monkeys about Afghanistan or Camp Bassin or the army or whatever, it's just a reflection of, at this time of year, it's lovely to be with your friends and family. But let's not forget that there are lots of people who aren't with their friends and family this year.
We've really seen people who've arrived and they have done their best work. They've shone. The contact that you've got here is with the military is very, very direct. You're in amongst the audience, and the audience is doing essentially what they're designed to do. People have come out here, and they have done an absolutely fantastic job. And that is partly because they're doing their job all the time. There is no distraction. It's a quite short but very intense period that they spend in their professional lives. And I don't think people always realise that before they come out, but they will do some of their best work out here.
BFBS is vital in that it reflects accurately what's going on with the UK forces wherever they are in the whole world. So in that way, absolutely vital. That link is vital. I've seen this week the reaction I've had on my show from people who are back in the UK, who are missing people out here in Afghanistan in particular, has been phenomenal. I've never seen a reaction like it before with anything that I've done. The reaction has been through the roof, more than we could ever have imagined, really. So in that way, it's such an amazing lifeline to have. And I think that needs to be celebrated, and that's why BFBS do such great work.
BFBS presenter and ops veteran, Rachel Cochran.
You know, it was going to the unknown. What was I going to see? What was I going to experience? Was I going to miss home? You know, as soon as you get on the plane, you're just this one little civilian surrounded by people in uniform. That's scary. That is scary. And they know what they're going to, and you don't.
You can't do what we do, working with the forces and not care. I don't see how you'd be able to do that, certainly without the audience knowing. I just didn't feel that I could go on being a forces broadcaster without having gone and done an ops tour.
People were shooting at us. People were shooting rockets at us. People were shooting big rockets at us. And we just got on with doing our jobs. And I look back at it sometimes and I think how I'm often amazed at how normal it became.
I feel really proud that I'm able to come out here and maybe make a little bit of a difference, put smiles on faces, make life a little bit easier, perhaps, even if it's only for 3 minutes in their day.
Servicemen and their families are a fairly astute and perceptive bunch of people. I think what makes a good soldier is knowing a fake when you see one, whether that's on a vehicle checkpoint or listening to the radio. So you've got to be real. You can't fake empathy.
I remember one particular incident using Skype to my folks back home, and the alarm went off halfway through. And so I said, "Oh, just hang on a sec." Disappeared off out of camera range, came back on. "Oh, what have you got that on?" Because we have to wear body armour and helmet. And of course, this is the drill. The alarm goes off, you wait for the banks to finish, get your body armour and helmet on, find some cover and whatever. You know, I came back on. "Oh, I've got to go now, Mum." "Oh, what are you wearing that for?" "Oh, I think it's a drill, Mum." You know, I'm there with this silly helmet on and this body armour. "Yeah, I've got to go now. Is everything all right?" "Yeah, everything's fine, Mum."
It's not a playground. It's not messing about. We're not playing DJs.
In news, telling the story is important. More important is getting the details right when your audience are subject matter experts. BFBS recognised that to truly serve its audience, it needed to produce its own bespoke service. It needed experience, insight, and most importantly, when it counted, feet on the ground. The campaign in Iraq, commonly known by the British public as Gulf War II, was the first time the station sent not only presenters and engineers, but journalists to the front lines. Many of them lived and worked alongside British forces on the ground, and two of those who were embedded reporters were Rory Higgins and Susie Ferguson.
We've been sat here close to the border for about 2 hours, and during that time, we've had helicopters flying over, American Cobras have been flying over, we've been able to hear artillery hitting the ground. I've seen plumes of black smoke coming up from the horizon. You can literally see, hear, feel the war happening around you, and yet the guys are just getting on with whatever they do. They've been washing, they've been shaving, they've been having their breakfast, having a laugh, having a joke. People have been making brews out of the back of their Warriors.
There's quite about 200 Iraqis that have crowded around the front of the vehicle. They're no more than about 10 feet away from me, and we're getting a lot of people running up to us as we go through the streets in the armoured vehicle, running towards us, smiling, giving us thumbs up, people clapping as well. So it's quite an amazing sight to see.
For operational reasons, I'm not allowed to say exactly where I am, but this morning I have been outside the town of Azerbaijan.
I'm just getting washed, sorting out my personal admin. We've got a big stove here, an outdoor stove now, so you can get hot water to wash in and also make yourself a cup of tea, which is pretty nice in the morning.
I think some of them were very suspicious at first. The attitude definitely changed once they heard me on the radio, and people kept coming up to me saying, "I heard you on the radio today." And I sort of thought, well, that is why I'm here. I think of them quite fondly, which I think is slightly strange.
Afghanistan often felt like a long way from home. At 3,500 miles away from the UK, its biggest challenge was often logistics. Getting people and goods in and out via an airbridge, a regular shuttle of Royal Air Force C-17s, C-130s and other aircraft capable of doing the heavy lifting required. But imagine the same challenge over 20 years earlier, this time 8,000 miles away, at the start of another conflict, this time in the Falkland Islands, in spring 1982.
And this is how it sounded in those first few moments of panic.
Red attack is now imminent. Hands to emergency station.
In that attack, three out of the four Mirages were shot down by ship and shore missile batteries and also machine gun fire.
Former Forces broadcaster Patrick Ead.
In 1982, the Falklands came along because of circumstances, but it certainly wasn't on the radar, because in 1982, the whole focus of the British Army was supporting the RUC in Northern Ireland and sitting in Germany to block the Warsaw Pact. The thing was, because I was working at Wiltshire Radio, and we were sitting in Wootton Bassett, and I used to look out of the studio window and see another Herc flying down the high street. And the fact that the guys at RAF Lynham and Bryce Norton used to listen to Wiltshire Radio. So I got to go to the Falklands as one of those editors abroad scheme. Before BFBS arrived in the Falklands, we were already providing a service for those on the task force sailing south.
I'm not allowed to say how many planes joined the raid, but I counted them all out and I counted them all back. Their pilots were unhurt, cheerful and jubilant, giving thumbs-up signs.
The Argentinians under Galtieri, who was their president at the time, were in a terrible state financially, economically and socially. And it is often believed that President Galtieri organised the invasion as a diversion from the terrible state that his government was in. At first, the reports came to London that these troop movements and ship movements were only to take part in an exercise with Uruguay to the north. It was clear that they weren't. They landed. They took over the Falklands. We had to say, okay, yours for the moment, we're coming after you.
After the war, BFBS had a man down there, it was Charlie Lowndes.
BFBS arrived in the Falklands a little while after the shooting had stopped and were welcomed by FIBS, Falkland Broadcasting Service. with the remarkable Patrick Watts, MBE. He got his decoration for, amongst other things, taking no notice of the Argentine special forces who invaded his radio station. In the course of the next few minutes, he uttered the immortal line, "I'm not saying anything with a gun in my back, go away."
They were forcibly invaded, they were degraded in many ways, and then when it came to setting free the Falklands, they were witness to horrendous fights. Many of the islanders would help the British troops with transport. They would offer up their tractors and their trailers to shift men, kit, bullets for the fight that lay ahead. I remember one occasion in Stanley, I was writing a report, I heard a big bang and a young Gurkha engineer had been killed as he was trying to clear ordnance. A very sad occasion. So loss of life was still going on 5 months after the end of the war.
We're under attack again.
Radio stations need a lot of stuff to make them work. But more importantly, they need an audience. The Forces audience might seem like any other. Mothers, fathers, sons, daughters. But thanks to the jobs they do, the places they live, and the lives they lead, the BFBS audience is quietly quite extraordinary.
I think there's something very special about the military community. Even though people are based right across the world, they have one thing in common, and that is that they're all in the military together.
Forces broadcaster Neil Moore.
The unique way that BFBS serves its audience is essentially by living with its audience, working day to day and alongside its audience, no matter where they happen to be around the world. I don't think you come across that with any other radio station or organisation around the world. Essentially, the camaraderie that the military has spills over into your life if you're a civilian working with them. You're just not going to get that anywhere else.
My name is Bex. I used to be in the Royal Air Force and I was a sergeant crewman on Chinook helicopters. Probably my toughest day was one of my first times out in theatre. We were embarking on a deliberate op from Kandahar, a 5-ship Chinook helicopter insert into a village. Early morning, the visibility was poor. It was my first deliberate op operated as a crewman, so I was quite scared. I don't think I'd slept at all that night before. We lifted all 5 aircraft. The vis was quite poor. We weren't quite sure what we were going to come across when we got to the location, whether it was going to be hot, were people going to be shooting at us or IEDs around. But when we landed on, we didn't land on in the normal way that we usually do. The dust cloud built in front of us. We couldn't see much that was on the ground. And as we touched the ground, the aircraft tilted forwards, the front blades nearly hit the floor, and everybody was thrown to the floor. After a few seconds, I tried to speak to my crew, but I couldn't speak to them. I could hear them, and there was no explosion, there was no fire. We needed to get the troops off. So I put the ramp down, off they went. I managed to get a microphone, speak to my crew, and let them know I was okay. We lifted off, and we started the transit back to Kandahar. And upon inspection from a Lynx helicopter that was flying near us, they found that we'd actually knocked off the front left undercarriage of the aircraft. Still to this day, we're not sure what we hit and what happened, how we managed to do that. On ops, BFBS played a big part. Every place we used to go as air crew before we went to go flying, BFBS would be on. The radio would be on in the armourers. The radio would be on in the kitchens, the radio would be on in the hangars. And often I kind of felt they would reflect the mood of the camp.
My name is the Reverend Gavin Smith and I'm currently serving as an army chaplain and have been for the last 12 years. I'm incredibly grateful for BFBS because of all the things we've discussed, that unique link with the families. Again, even with emails and sort of FaceTime and everything like that, there is something about gathering people together in a community centre. And I think, again, that's that key of BFBS is part of our community. That's the one thing that technology and everything else that goes on in the world cannot replicate. And I think that's the strength of BFBS, it's a friend, it's a part of our community. It's always been there to support us.
My name's Tim Frogley. I am a squadron leader in the Royal Air Force and I'm a logistics officer. When you're on an operational detachment, what they bring is an element of normalisation. You do get opportunities to listen to all the latest music, and you could be anywhere in the world listening to that, not just in an operational war zone. So they give you that element of escape from where you are. They also bring you a sense of understanding. They know what the tone of the detachment's like, if it's been a bad couple of days. they will reflect that and they will respect it.
Having a corporal walk into my studio, his wife was in the studio there, and this big, huge, roughy, toughy soldier being absolutely reduced to tears talking to his wife on the phone in the studio. He was in Iraq, his wife was in a studio in Edinburgh. That sums it up to me.
At the end of the second decade of the 21st century, broadcast radio is a century old. The first regular station was launched in 1920 in the USA. In the meantime, BFBS has been busy building a very specialised set of skills. As of 2019, BFBS have multiple TV channels serving most of its overseas outposts. Its MyPlayer platform even brings the best of British TV to an audience in need of small screen nourishment. Its expert digital team creates content to meet the demand created by online platforms like social media and video streaming sites. Its Forces Media Academy retrains Forces veterans to be working media professionals. While technological and social changes have driven BFBS to become so much more than a radio station, at its heart, that single voice in Algiers has become a chorus of radio, TV, digital and learning services. BFBS has more than 20 radio stations or digital channels. It can be heard online, on the BFBS app, and still, of course, on the radio. So, 100 years on, why is radio still so relevant and in demand?
I'm Ernie Rowe. I've worked for BFBS for about 28 years. I think radio will always be important because, yes, of course, you can interact online and you can get the music that you want from streaming agencies. But where do you get conversation from? Where do you get the, oh, God, I know the answer to that. What's the answer? And I think that's what's different about radio, because there's a human voice who's live and interactive, but you don't even have to get in touch to interact.
Forces broadcaster Neil Moore.
Radio does do that. It can reach places in the middle of a desert where there is no internet connectivity, there's no phones. All you need is a little radio and a battery. If you're transmitting that signal and you can pick it up, you're instantly in that person's space.
Radio can be ever present in the background, not necessarily too invasive, so you can always have it on while you're doing other activities. It can be on in the hangar with the technicians doing their work. It can be music, or it can be an information service. And when you're deployed on operations, knowing what's going on the base or what's going on around the world, or simply just having a bit of music, is something that can always be there while you're still able to focus on your primary job. So I think that's why it's so useful and why it's so much appreciated by certainly all the servicemen and women that I know.
I think the radio is a really powerful tool, especially out here. When you don't have Facebook, you don't have Twitter, and very often you don't have your email out here, you've got the radio and you can connect to somebody back home. Maybe somebody you're working with that's in a different room. You can connect to them through the radio.
BFBS is the one thing that you don't have to pack. We are wherever you are if you're in the forces world. If you're on your own, we're there by your side experiencing it. So we're company apart from anything else. I don't think there'll be a time when radio isn't relevant.
How do you use a radio to protect and even save lives? In Cyprus, 45 years ago, a political, social and military crisis loomed, then erupted on this seemingly peaceful and idyllic Mediterranean island.
When I joined BFBS at the end of 1975, there was a great deal of discussion about the role that BFBS had played the year before, 1974, during the Turkish invasion of Cyprus.
Former Forces broadcaster Charlie Lowndes.
British military families got rather caught up in it and needed to be evacuated. BFBS was able to coordinate the evacuation of quite large numbers of people through a war zone. To be able to get this done safely was seen as a vindication of what the operational role of BFBS could be in an emergency.
The situation is confused. There has been fighting in various areas extending outwards from the ceasefire line and airstrikes on several parts of the island. Those in the Kyrenia area should remain where they are.
I will send a further message to you on BFBS when there's an important change in the situation.
Christopher Lee.
1974, you had the Turks in the north and the Greeks in the south. And there was the threat, according to the Turks, that Greece would threaten northern Cyprus. And so it was a natural thing for the Turks to take the opportunity and sweep in. I mean, the irony was that the fact that a lot of naval officers had their properties in northern Cyprus. And in fact, one admiral had to send a ship to get his famous paintings out of northern Cyprus before the Turks took them over.
Broadcasting in an emergency is still an extremely efficient way of doing things. Cell phone systems tend to creak under the strain, and when you get massive floods and power cuts and so on, even in Britain today, the cell phone structure tends to break down fairly early on. So the advice is always tune into your local radio station. Well, for our listeners, that was BFBS. Being able to provide that service was an important rationale for why keep a lot of expensive people and some gleaming studios and some transmitters and masts in some far-flung corner of the world. Well, that was one of the reasons.
Forces broadcaster Mario Chrysostomou.
We were running a restaurant, chalking out daily specials on the board outside, and I had a hankering for mum and grandmum's lentil casserole, so I made some up for myself and the family. I thought, well, we'll chalk it up and see if there's any takers out there. Lo and behold, who now turns out to have been a Dolby engineer who was on Ireland sorting out the Astra Cinema at Akrotiri. That caught his eye. He came in, had a bowl of lentil casserole, loved it, came back in the evening with another engineer and a radio engineer. And then over the course of the next few weeks, more and more engineers came over from BFBS, and then they brought over presenters. And over the space of then the next couple of years, it became affectionately known as Studio 3, BFBS Cyprus. A lot of the presenters used to come and socialise, shall we say. And then I'd always loved my music, always was a bit, let's not say gobby, let's say gregarious. So I got to know them and then got chatting with Chris Pearson one Friday evening and said, what this station is missing is a good classic dance show. And that was my first foray into the wonderful world of radio. So in terms of morale, there's no doubt that, you know, even though Cyprus is a great place to be, you're still essentially a long way from family and loved ones. And even though the military has this way of, you know, embracing its own and others, you're still very much understanding that, if not least because of the weather, you are a long way from home. So BFBS is that kind of, it's been said before, and it maybe sounds a bit twee, but it's just so accurate. It is that community glue. There's a bit of morale there. There's a bit of connectivity. You'll hear your name, you'll hear the names of your buddies, and it just joins up the whole forces community in a way that maybe wouldn't happen even with social media. You know, it wouldn't happen without that these days.
BFBS has witnessed the British forces through the tension of peacekeeping in Bosnia. It shared the tension and fear on our own doorstep in Northern Ireland. It's been an everyday part of the lives of people both in and out of uniform. Soldiers, sailors and airmen and women, their husbands, wives, children and wider family. But in 2019, Germany, Europe and much of the Western world looked back to one of the most significant world events of the late 20th century. An event that BFBS found itself slap bang in the middle of.
28 years and 3 months after the Berlin Wall went up, the very symbol of East-West divide, the most amazing scenes. I'm standing on top of the infamous Berlin Wall, right in front of the Brandenburg Gate. There are thousands and thousands of Berliners alongside me. Over in the east, the sun is shining on the radio tower, the rays reflecting in the form of a cross on its glass. Berliners say that this cross is a symbol of hope that one day Berlin will be won again.
One of the station's finest hours came 30 years ago, in 1989.
As every bit of the observation platform is dismantled and thrown or lowered to the ground, cheers come up from the crowd here on the western side of Bernauerstrasse. The crowd now must be numbering 1,000 or 2,000. So after 28 years, the Berlin Wall is as porous as a sieve. By Tuesday, Bernauerstrasse will once again be open from east to west Berlin, and say the East German authorities, it won't be closed again.
Forces broadcaster Jamie Gordon.
Geographically, Berlin was almost smack bang in the middle of East Germany, maybe a tad to the north. But everybody who lived in the west to get to that city had to go through corridors, whether it was an air corridor, given that aircraft had to fly on a particular route into a particular airport, or if you wanted to leave the city by the British military train, that was an option that we had that civilians didn't. Again, it was a train which was heavily guarded by Russian and East German authorities. You had to go through so many hoops in terms of paperwork to get on that train. But I remember the most interesting for me was the Berlin Corridor is what it was called. And it was the road link between West Berlin and West Germany. And it was on a designated route. You were given a map. You had to follow that route. You had to check out of West Berlin with the Russians and you had to follow this route. You had to do it in a certain time. No less and no more, because that would indicate A, you were speeding, or B, you were stopping for something and that would not go down well. And then you checked out when you got to Braunschweig, which was the point at which West Germany started and East Germany finished. It was an extraordinary adventure, and as somebody 17 to 18 year old to do that when we went to play hockey, for example, in West Germany, it was an extraordinary experience.
Berlin was no ordinary city. It was divided by the Cold War. Everyday people lived completely different lives, just meters apart, thanks to the Berlin Wall. On one side, a Western city thrived, while on the other, people like draftswoman Heidi Brower were partially leading a secret life as illegal BFBS listeners.
You could argue that listening to BFBS was fraternising with the enemy. And in fact, there's a well-documented lady who I had the pleasure of meeting up with earlier on this year to make a documentary that I did for Berlin 30, The Fall of the Wall. She was called Heidi Brower. She lived in the eastern part of Berlin and she used to phone BFBS on a regular basis. But she used different payphones every time she called, because she knew she was being watched and potentially listened to, and speaking to the enemy, which was in fact what she was doing, carried a jail sentence. So it was a very serious thing that she was doing, but she persevered. She learned her English by listening to us and by taping presenters on air and then going back over the tapes and learning her English like that with a dictionary.
In October 1977, suddenly I had music on my radio, Elvis songs. There were songs I hadn't heard before, but most of all, I was astonished to listen to the presenter. That was Peter McDonough. He had a very special voice, and he was a very special, funny character. And so I was keen to hear more of his shows. And from that day, I listened every day. It was fixed on my radio. I couldn't understand a lot of the words, so I taped everything and looked in my dictionary to learn the words. And after 4 weeks, I was ready to get in touch with them, to phone, not from home, of course, because it was contact with an enemy. I could have faced 10 to 12 years prison. But I had no idea that it was a military broadcasting. It was just, I went to Berlin, phoned the station, and I said, hello, I'm calling from the East. I just can't say my Christian name, Heidi. And I was so lucky. It was Tony Austin on the phone, not the secretary. And so he was astonished too. I had no idea that he was just since 3 weeks in Berlin. He came over from the UK. And he was astonished too, to listen to me. But in the end, he said, I will play a song for you. I listened to it 1 hour later on the radio, and he said in the end, and this song was for you, courtesy of the Free West. The word courtesy, I had no idea what it meant. I looked in the dictionary again. And that was the beginning of a friendship. I'm quite sure I'm the only one who still remembers the phone number of BFBS Berlin. That was 309-5265.
An incredible story, and the risks that she undertook just to listen to us put our existence in big perspective.
There are about 50 border guards that are pushing forward and appear to be pushing the people back. They stop about 5 metres from the wall. Some of the people are trying to scrabble back on top of the block. This is amazing. Something that I don't think anybody thought would ever actually happen. The youngsters that jumped down onto the eastern side have now scrambled back on top of the wall, and the border guards just standing and watching, doing absolutely nothing. East and West Berliners hugging each other. Bottles of champagne are being opened. It really is the most amazing scenes.
The British forces' story in the UK, for many years, was focused on one part of the UK, a place that became known for its troubles.
In 1969, a civil unrest was such that the then Assistant Chief Constable could not control it anymore without bringing troops onto the streets. You then entered a state of war, although it wasn't called a state of war at the beginning, and that really didn't finish until much later with the Good Friday Agreement. The Good Friday Agreement was really the major dissident forces in their political form, like Sinn Féin IRA, as well as the Protestant forces agreeing to work together with the setting up of an assembly of government. That only took place because the Americans sent Senator Mitchell, who acted as the go-between and managed to pull the whole thing together.
Forces broadcaster Rachel Cochran.
Even though I grew up in a very protected environment, as a farmer's daughter, in an area where we didn't know anything about the Troubles, and I was a child of the 80s, I feel lucky that I was protected from it. But as the decades have gone on, and as I've grown up, and I've worked for BFBS, and I've got to know our community, our military community, the veteran community, I've done a lot of interviews and been to a lot of homes of veterans who have really struggled since the Troubles and have had a lot of ongoing problems, whether it be post-traumatic stress, whether they've physically been injured. And I remember going to a very isolated house to talk to a veteran. I sat down to do the interview, which was only going to take about 3 minutes. And 3 hours later, I was still there. His story was incredible. And I said, my goodness, I just feel as though all this was happening around me and I knew nothing about it. As a result of that, I came out completely unscathed, as did many people. It was so hard for so many.
The state of play in Northern Ireland in the latter end of 2019 is that we come back to the political feast that existed beforehand, and that is the relationship between Northern Ireland and Ireland. It is unstable, but hasn't broken down as yet.
To then be able to go to Afghanistan and say, well, now it's my time to do something to help in some small way. To just go on the radio and chat to people, if that can help. If a mum is listening to the same radio station as her son is listening to, and he might be in, you know, a forward operating base in Afghanistan, it helps her feel closer to him, even though they're separated by thousands of miles. And he's facing huge danger. And that was the case during one of my first tour, actually, where I knew that a young guy who my brother had gone to school with, he was out on the ground in a pretty precarious place in Afghanistan. His mum used to get up in the middle of the night to listen to the show. And she listened to it because she knew that he was also listening to it. And for that reason, well, she just felt closer to him. Very sadly, this particular soldier died after I'd come home. And I remember just how devastating that was.
Friendships. These are at the heart of everyday life for all of us. Once in a while we make a new friend, and occasionally we say goodbye as friends move away. In the forces, hellos and goodbyes come thick and fast as the BFBS audience spends its working life moving from posting to posting every 3 years. Goodbyes also exist on a much grander scale. In 1997, BFBS ended a very special relationship with an extraordinary place and did what it does best: tell unique stories about Forces life.
I first encountered BFBS in Hong Kong in 1994 when I arrived there on a posting with the Royal Navy.
Forces broadcaster Neil Moore.
BFBS was an integral part of the community there, and it was also part of your joining routine. So when you went round and met all the various people in the location, went and saw all the different sites within the military environment there, BFBS broadcast on the final day right up until just before midnight. And I did present a show on that final day between 10 and 12. We all had to pre-record our shows on that final day because the studio, which towards the end of Hong Kong's time under British rule, became an ISO container in the car park because the studio was all being dismantled and taken apart. It literally was that close to the wire on the final day that BFBS stopped transmitting in Hong Kong.
The eyes of the world are on Hong Kong today. I wish you all a successful transition and a prosperous and peaceful future.
That speech from His Royal Highness, the Prince of Wales, and the rain pouring down here at East Tamar. Sheets of rain falling across the arena, but not one of the 474 people on parade flinching.
Essentially, just after midnight, all of the military personnel who were still on Hong Kong Island were bussed round to the international airport, and there were jumbo jets waiting, which I believe left about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning to fly back to the UK. Now, us being on Royal Navy ships, we were left anchored in the harbour and we proceeded to leave Hong Kong at our own steady pace, right behind Her Majesty's Yacht Britannia, which had Prince Charles on board, who was taking the ceremony duties there. So that was the first ship to leave, as is the custom in the Royal Navy. The senior ship leaves first. We were the final ship from the Royal Navy to leave Hong Kong waters. It was a weird scenario because it was all the hoo-ha and the celebration of handing the colony back and moving and everyone leaving. We were left to sail off to the Philippines and we didn't catch up until several months later.
It's never easy to say goodbye, but we must look to the future. We wish everyone in Hong Kong good luck. As they say in English and in the local Chinese dialect, this is Rory Higgins saying, for the final time, bye-bye.
In 2019, there were nearly 20 ways to listen to a radio station that started life in the back of a 4-ton army truck, sitting in the sand in the dying days of the North Africa campaign, as the final chapter of the world's most terrible conflict drew to a close. These roots are important. They define the station's existence. BFBS sits at the heart of Forces communities, filled with people doing hard, challenging, extraordinary things. Through 7 decades of historic events, it's been not only a constant witness of history, but it's also served as a constant, reliable friend, ally, and a strong voice for the unique community of people it committed itself to serving.
I remember being in Iraq and laying under the desk and trying to play Razorlight when the rockets were coming in. And it's not because any of us are anything special, it's because it's our job and we've signed up to it and we love it with a passion.
Forces broadcaster, Ginny Carlin.
I was so full of different emotions, and one of the things before I went, I met with the ops manager, Dusty, and he said to me to prepare myself for going out that it was different to Iraq in the respect that there was so much air traffic going around and that you would hear the Chinook, the Mert Chinook, going over the top of your cabin in the middle of the night. He told me about how that made him feel, and we both got quite upset. And I took that away with me when I went to Afghanistan. And the first night I got there, it was about 2 o'clock in the morning and the Mert went over my cabin so low and so hot that I thought that it was going to take the top of my cabin roof off. And Dusty's words came back to me that it's not a playground, that it's not messing about, that we're not playing DJs. The thought that there were people on that aircraft and what he'd said, I think that set my tour up, really. I think it set me up for doing the very best that I could.
Former Commander-in-Chief of British Forces on Operation Granby, the Gulf War, General Sir Peter de la Billière.
There's 3 requirements that a serviceman has to keep him happy. He wants his mail, he wants his food, and he wants information. And the Forces Broadcasting Service has a high responsibility to provide that third leg in the requirements of the morale of a serviceman.
For operational reasons, I'm not allowed to say exactly where I am, but this morning I have been outside.
Battalion Remy in Austin, Berkshire, says a mention,
close
please,
to the border for about 2 hours, and during that time we've had helicopters flying over American Cobras.
A Forces broadcaster has to have genuine affection for the Forces audience, respect, reverence, and, do you know what, be open to friendship and ribbing and be able to take it. But above all, a Forces presenter cares about the Forces.
I know what I saw in Iraq. Expect the unexpected and you'll never be disappointed. The respect that you will gain by getting stuck in, and that experience can never be taken away from you, and you'll probably remember it for the rest of your life.
I enjoy the effect of what we do has on other people, and it has a big effect.
The key thing about BFBS was to reflect the community we broadcast within. What made BFBS special was that it was very, very local radio. We lived among, we worked alongside our audience. That closeness with the community created a flavour all of its own.
BFBS has got as much future as it has a past, and I think that reflects the way of the world.
BFBS was, even though we felt it was owned, we were being looked after, we were being served well by the organisation.
From my experience, they are absolutely accepted into the culture and into the environment, and everybody absolutely appreciates the job that they do, and it absolutely adds value to the detachment and the people out there.
Every day is different, but every day has its own challenges and its own joys, because you're part of a huge and a large and a well-loved community.
As a serving person in Hong Kong, it was just a lifeline, because quite often you'd be days at sea or days alongside where you weren't at home with your family, and BFBS would always be playing. It would always be there in the background. It was great for sport. You got to follow all your teams, and it was just like being back at home. Everybody had the station's phone number, and everybody would be in touch with the station all the time.
Seeing both ends of those messages and then having the phone go and the person on the other end of that doing a message back, that's what it's all about.
I think if you go back in history, it was one of the only ways to get a message from somebody to their loved ones elsewhere. Getting a message was part of a culture which is, I think, became ingrained in the nature of forces broadcasting.
I've been doing it for 25 years. I'd have packed my bags and gone somewhere else a long time ago if it wasn't the best job in the world.
Because it's the most rewarding.
I was a relatively young presenter and really didn't know anything about Afghanistan. All I knew was what was on the news, and that was really scary. So to get the opportunity to go out there as a radio presenter, I've never forgotten just how incredibly privileged I felt when I was doing that job.
For us to be able to serve them, entertain them, inform them, makes it, in my eyes, the best job in the world.
BFBS 75, A Witness on History, is an original Forces programme presented by Mike Howarth and written and produced by Andrew Wright. We dedicate this programme to all the extraordinary people BFBS has had the privilege to serve over the past 75 years.
On digital radio, FM, and satellite TV in the UK.
Online and on air around the world.
This is Forces Radio.
Forces Radio.